Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Antioch University, New England, helping students change the world with graduate degrees in environmental studies, psychology, education, and management. antioch.edu/new-england.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The state attorney general begins an investigation into allegations of sexual misconduct by three Dartmouth College professors. Ted Gatzis and Joyce Craig debate ahead of Manchester's mayoral election, and a storm last weekend still leaves many Granite Staters in the dark. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them this hour, and we'd like you to lend your voice to this conversation. What about this week's news do you want to know? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and NHPR reporter Breeder Green. Thank you very much for being here, everybody.
Good morning, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And we are also live streaming a video of this broadcast. You can watch it live on our Facebook page. We're going to start the show today talking about a variety of stories having to do with sexual misconduct. Again, the phone number for you to lend your voice to this part of the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. So, and just a fair warning to folks who may be listening with young children in the car or nearby is that we're going to be talking about sexual misconduct. So please bear that in mind as you listen for the next 20 minutes or so. So let's start with you, Breeda, because you've been covering the story about these allegations made against these three Dartmouth professors. Who are they, first of all?
Right. So it's three professors in the college's psychological and brain sciences department. Their names are Todd Heatherton, Paul Whalen, and Bill Kelly. They're all pretty well respected in the field, pretty well known. Todd Heatherton was briefly chair of the department, and they've collaborated in the past, but we don't know if the allegations have to do anything with their research.
Do we know anything about the allegations themselves?
Just no.
Nothing yet?
No. We know very little about what's caused these investigations.
Okay. And this story originated not with the college necessarily putting out a statement, but with the college's newspaper, right?
That's right. My understanding is last week, the Dartmouth, which is Dartmouth's student newspaper, saw posters that had been put up in the psychological studies department building that said on them, "Where is Professor Paul Whalen? Where is Professor Bill Kelly?" And then they reached out to the administration to say, "Hey, what's up with these posters?" And the administration then put out a statement confirming that they had an ongoing investigation into these three professors and that they had been banned from being on campus.
Mm-hmm. And now the Attorney General's office in the state is involved. At what point did they get involved? What prompted their involvement?
So they saw the news reports, and then they spoke with the college and found out that there had been allegations of sexual misconduct. That was not in the college's original statement. The college had said serious misconduct, so we got a little more detail this week. And then the Attorney General's office decided to launch its own investigation. That's a law enforcement investigation involving both state and local law enforcement departments at that point. So that was this week.
Mm-hmm. And how have these professors responded?
So we haven't heard from two of them. We've heard from one of them. That's Todd Heatherton, who had briefly been chair of the department, and he has spoken only through his attorneys. They've really tried to distance him from the other two. They say that the investigation that the college has ongoing into him has to do with some incident that happened off campus, out of state, out of New Hampshire, and we don't know what that incident is. They say that it has nothing to do with the conduct of the other two, and that he's never violated any, you know, sexual harassment policies of the university, anything like that.
Mm-hmm. And so I imagine this is kind of a disturbing thing for folks at Dartmouth, in the Dartmouth community, to hear. You've been doing some reporting on the ground in the Upper Valley. What are you hearing on campus?
Yeah, so I mean, I spoke with a handful of undergraduates who say that, of course, everyone's talking about it. This was at the Psychological and Brain Sciences Department, but that there's just a lot of rumors flying around. You know, there's not much there. It's obviously not putting a great mood in the department. Speaking to professors, you get a sense that things are not looking up. It obviously is a bad reputational news story for that department, but there's not a whole lot of information going around.
And Dean, you've been following Breida's reporting on this. Sure. What were your thoughts when you heard that this story was coming up?
Well, it was obviously a surprise to hear. All three of these individuals are well-established professors. They run labs. They bring in big federal grants. They have a lot of graduate students working with them. So it's a significant thing. And, you know, as is the case with any investigation of this sort, there's just not a lot of information to be had. I'm sure there are real concerns for the college in terms of the viability of their grants. These individuals are probably, I'm not 100% sure, but I assume they're all tenured. So there's an additional code that goes along with that in terms of conduct. So it's going to be interesting to watch it develop. But it was surprising. It's getting national coverage. We'll see where it goes. But I thought it was interesting, as Britta mentioned, that this caught the eye of local law enforcement only because it was in the college newspaper. So there's a plug for collegiate journalism.
Mm-hmm. So Britta, where is this going to play out? Is it going to play out both in the courts and in internal Dartmouth disciplinary hearings? What are we going to see here as far as making this right?
Right. So there's two separate investigations. Actually, the college has multiple investigations going on. We don't know exactly how those are sort of delineated between the professors. But there is an internal process at Dartmouth College to deal with allegations that would involve sexual misconduct. Again, we don't know what the specific allegations are. And then the law enforcement investigation is separate from that. In New Hampshire, there's no mandatory reporting requirement for private schools to report allegations of sexual misconduct to law enforcement unless it involves minors or the elderly. There's reasons for that. I think, victims in many cases feel more comfortable coming forward to college officials if they know they won't be going through an entire law enforcement process. But we'll just have to see sort of how it plays out in both venues.
All right. Well, sadly, this is not the only story we've covered this week on allegations of sexual misconduct. And another one that came out late this week has to do with St. Paul's School here in Concord. A new report from St. Paul's School named more professors involved in sexual misconduct with students. Some of this was already known, but some of it's new. The school has been investigating allegations that date back decades. And let's go to you, Kevin Landrigan, union leader, reporter. So what's new in this report?
Well, essentially, this second report, this supplemental report, comes out as a result of the first one, which was done in May by the school, which they hired a Boston law firm that looked into allegations of sexual misconduct by faculty and staff. And once they put out that report, they essentially put out the clarion call to other alumni or students, anybody who was affiliated with the campus. If you have concerns, come to us. Speak to this law firm. And that resulted in a whole nother raft of allegations against folks. In this supplemental report, there are allegations against 16 faculty and staff, and five of them weren't in the first report. So they're new allegations. Four of those staff were named in this report, and the fifth person was not identified.
Mm-hmm. And what's the nature of those new allegations?
Well, they sort of run the gamut in terms of inappropriate sexual contact and behavior, ranging from making sexually suggestive comments to students that made them feel uncomfortable to actual sexual assault. So the Attorney General's office got involved after the May report was released and indicated we're going to do a criminal investigation into a lot of these allegations. And they have since said, since this second report has come out, that we're going to look at these reports as well. And it's important to point out that the first report dealt with allegations up to 1988. This report deals with the period from 1956 to 2009. That's important because of the statute of limitations with regard to a lot of potential crimes. In the first report, many of those crimes that occurred by staff and faculty against students or against anyone may not be able to be prosecuted. But these more recent allegations certainly could be. And that's why this second report may be even more fertile territory for the Attorney General's office than the first report was.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the school saying now about this new supplemental report?
They're essentially saying that the allegations here are profoundly disturbing and painful to see and hear, but it's important we all go through this and we continue to be supportive and be very cooperative with the Attorney General's investigation. That's sort of what's interesting about this week's developments. I think you're seeing what's happening in the area of sexual assault, certainly with the Harvey Weinstein scandal. We're seeing institutions coming to grips with how do we deal with this very difficult subject. And certainly St. Paul's School's initial experiences were very much like Dartmouth, which is we're investigating this incident. It involves some staff. We're not going to tell the public what it's about. It's serious misconduct. We're not going to suggest initially that this is about sexual assault or sexual misconduct until the Attorney General's office gets involved and finds out that's what it is, that it's a sexual crime. That's how St. Paul's dealt with this initially. Then they did this report, and they had the experts interview a bunch of people, and they came to realize there was a systemic problem with students and even people visiting the school being preyed upon by people working at St. Paul's School. And I think St. Paul's School's administration has now really turned the corner. And I think they're very proactive in trying to get as much information as possible about it and being very proactive and public in this report. There are very disturbing details in this report that I dare say a year ago, 2 years ago, you would have never seen in a report by St. Paul's School about their staff.
Well, that's fascinating, too, and I'd love to hear from listeners on that point. How do you think institutions grappling with allegations of sexual assault are doing? Give us a call. Lend your voice to that part of the conversation, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And NHPR News Director Dan Barrick, you wanted to weigh in?
Well, you know, Kevin just mentioned the efforts at transparency by the school here. They reached out proactively to the media to release this report on the day that it was sent out to members of their community. There was the school didn't take would not return would not answer questions for, at least from our staff, and I didn't see them anywhere else. But I think they're portraying this as a real cleansing effort. One thing that I found interesting, Kevin also mentioned the Attorney General's investigation around this. And it's important to remember, the AG's office is investigating the school's response. They're not investigating necessarily individual, although I'm sure that will be part of it. But they've emphasized they're investigating the school for possible issues around failure to report and failure to protect their students. One of the top attorneys in the Department of Justice was quoted, I think, in the Concord Monitor yesterday as saying that they had not received a copy of this report from the school, that they got it through the media, which I, you know, you can make of that what you will, but I think it indicates that there's clearly some tension between the two institutions, the AG's office and the school, about how to resolve this investigation.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the door might be open for lawsuits of some kind.
But yeah, I imagine so, yeah.
Yeah. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Later in this hour, we're going to be talking about the Manchester mayoral race. Voters in Manchester go to the polls next week. What do you make of the debates between incumbent Mayor Ted Gatsis and challenger Joyce Craig? Give us a call now to join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page, at NHPR Exchange. And remember, you can watch a video of our in-studio conversation streaming right now at our Facebook page. Shift to another story really quickly. Hudson State Representative Eric Schlein made a brief court appearance Monday as the prosecution and defense worked out a trial date on charges. He sexually assaulted a teenage girl. Kevin, union leader's been reporting on this. What are the allegations against him?
Well, essentially, it's one count of sexual assault and two counts of simple assault against the state representative. Authorities say that he met this 16-year-old victim at a cafe back in July, where they talked about politics and her interest in a political career. And then the second time they met up, she claims he assaulted her, and he has denied all the allegations.
Okay. And so has the House taken any disciplinary action on him?
They have not. And that's pretty typical of the way the legislature deals with these kind of very difficult cases, which is, you're innocent until proven guilty. I mean, once this case is adjudicated in any way, shape or form, I expect the House at that point would take up any ethics allegations against this legislator.
Okay. Don't have a whole lot more information on that case, but one more case of sexual misconduct that we should cover before the break, and that's that Michael Oreskes of NPR in D.C. left his position after allegations that he sexually harassed two women seeking career opportunities nearly decades ago, two decades ago when he worked at the New York Times. He's also facing some allegations now for his conduct at NPR. Dan Barrick, what was he accused of doing when he was employed at NPR?
Well, at NPR, the one concrete allegation that's come forward is that he met with a junior female staffer and had what began as a professional dinner, sort of a networking dinner, career advice, and the woman says that it veered into very deeply uncomfortable personal territory. But what I think what sort of broke this story and led to Oreskes' downfall was the Washington Post reporting earlier this week that when Oreskes was, I believe he was the head of the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, that he had assaulted two women there. It pretty quickly unraveled for Oreskes after that. He was put on administrative leave and then I believe just the next day asked to resign. What's been interesting is, both as a member of the media and as somebody employed in public radio, is watching the reporting on this, and in particularly NPR CEO Yarmon's response. He was interviewed by Kelly McEvers by Mary Louise Kelly on the air. Was it yesterday or Wednesday?
I believe it was Wednesday. Yeah,
and I think the consensus was that his answer was less than satisfactory about what the organization knew about Oreskes' alleged behavior. What their concerns were, whether they felt they acted swiftly enough to insulate and protect other employees. David Folkenflik, the media reporter for NPR, has reported that he's since this week talked to, I think, up to a half a dozen current NPR staffers who've reported disturbing conduct with Oreskes. And if you talk to people employed at NPR, they say it was an open secret that Oreskes had allegations of this in his past. So Moen says that NPR, that they're bringing an outside attorney or investigator of some kind to assess their response and move forward from that. He's claimed an open door policy from now on, to sort of allow employees to come forward and vent their frustrations or feedback on this. But it's certainly shocked that organization. And it's, as Kevin indicated, it's just another example of, especially within media and entertainment, further allegations and further, sort of leaders in that industry falling from their perches.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're speaking with NHPR's Dan Barrick and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. NHPR's Brita Green had joined us for this first part of the show. Brita, thank you very much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
And if you've got questions about the week's news, something the press didn't catch, maybe, please let us know. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the opioid crisis and Manchester Police Chief Nick Willard's assertion that the opioid crisis is not a law enforcement issue. It's a social services issue, and social service agencies need to step up. Call us now to join that conversation when it starts. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello, and we'll be right back.
Creative process isn't always easy, but getting distracted can be.
It feels like you're writing, but it's the equivalent of empty calories.
If you're looking, I have to write 500 words a day, it's not on Twitter. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, your source for the productive habits we can all benefit from, along with the guilty pleasures we can all relate to. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and NHPR News Director Dan Barrick. It's been a busy week for reporters in the Granite State, and now is your chance to get some answers to questions about what's been happening in the news. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the Manchester mayoral race. Call us now so we can bring you into the discussion. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we jump into a conversation about the Manchester mayoral race, we're going to need your help for some reporting we're going to be doing in the coming months. NHPR's newsroom is going to be examining the cost of living in the Granite State for an upcoming series, and you can help steer our reporting by submitting questions related to your life in New Hampshire, whether it be about childcare, housing, food, transportation, work, social life, even the cost of trash pickup. We've got a contact form at our website. Visit nhpr.org and tell us your questions about New Hampshire's cost of living. All right, so let's leap into a conversation about the Manchester mayoral race. Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis and challenger Joyce Craig met for a debate on NHPR this week. Election Day is coming right up. They spent some time talking about the opioid crisis. So, Dan Barrick, how did they distinguish themselves on that issue?
Well, in a number of ways, the mayor pointed to as he has throughout the campaign a number of areas that he considers a success. The Safe Station program that actually got a nod from the president last week at his conference, pointed to some numbers about other statistics that indicate things are getting under control. One area where they really did distinguish, though, I think was sort of somewhat new on the stump, at least, was about actually at the state level, the state's Medicaid expansion program, which, as we know, is up for renewal later next year. And there's a lot of debate around that. Craig said that she's firmly in favor of renewing that in some form, and she pointed out the benefit that it provides to those suffering from addiction. That there's the coverage it provides for those who are seeking addiction recovery and treatment services. The mayor was much less clear. He said, that he needs to see the legislation. That it was very hard to pin him down on that. And so that was especially as someone who's. He himself is a veteran of the State House. He obviously knows that legislation goes through many forms. But I was surprised that there wasn't a slightly more concrete answer there from him.
Mm-hmm. And along other subjects having to do with Manchester, taxes seems to be a big one. Dean, how did these two candidates sort of differentiate themselves on taxes?
There's been a big debate over taxes. In fact, I think Ted Gatz has said that the taxes are as important, if not more important, than dealing with the opioid crisis for his constituents. And it's not uncommon to paint Democrats as favoring more spending and higher taxes. Just to sort of kind of overall, the big issues, opioids, education, taxes, and infrastructure, I mean, those are sort of four pretty meaty topics for any mayoral race. On education, for example, we've heard those sort of familiar arguments. Craig has been very critical of Mayor Gatsis for spending money on building renovations rather than it going towards students and faculty. She's noted that the test scores are down in Manchester, and Gatsis's response as well. That's a function of the new Smarter Balanced assessment test. Test scores are down across the state. We talked about that last week. So, you know, very familiar set of arguments. Again, opioids, education, taxes, and infrastructure pretty much hits all the key issues that they talked about in the debate.
Give us a call if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to Jim in Manchester. Jim, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning, gentlemen. So the Manchester mayoral race, a lot of money is being spent, and reportedly close to perhaps or approaching $500,000 from each candidate being spent on this race. My question is, how important is it? Does it matter? I mean, it seems that reading the tea leaves in Manchester that Joyce Craig may be successful this time. My question is, does it matter in state politics whether the mayor of Manchester is a Republican or a Democrat, and how why so much money being spent?
Good question, Jim. Thank you very much for calling. So two-part question there. One, does the party of the candidate for mayor of Manchester matter? And two, why so much money? We'll go to you, Dan.
It's a really good question about the party affiliation, especially within a larger state. Officially, the elections in Manchester municipal elections are nonpartisan. And in some ways, you know, a lot of the job is sort of typical municipal functions and not terribly partisan. But, you know, for one example of how, you know, party affiliation might help, you don't have to look much further back than just a couple weeks ago when the mayor was able to go to the State House and ask for state funding from, you know, Republican Mayor Gatsis went to visit with the Republican Governor Sununu and asked for and received, I think, $150,000 or some amount to support the Safe Stations program. The mayor argued that the majority of people using that program are from out of the city, from out of Manchester, and therefore it's a state function as well. You know, a legitimate argument, a good point, a worthy program. But I think it was probably a lot easier for him to get a sit down with the mayor so publicly because of that. But, you know, the mayor is also in the legislature can be the leading advocate, can be sort of the lobbyist for the city. And having those, you know, a lot of your success in advocating for your city in the State House, a lot of it does just come down to politics, too.
Yeah, you know, it's important to remember that this is an off-year election. So the Manchester mayoral race is probably the most high-profile race in the state. There are no congressional elections. There's no presidential election. Turnout will be much lower. Typically, you get 20% or less in terms of turnout. So it really is, you know, parties are important to the extent that they help with competitive mobilization. Democrats have been, if you spend any time on Twitter, they've been pushing very hard at all levels for Joyce Craig. Same thing with Ted Gatsis, as Dan mentioned, being able to leverage Republican support at the Capitol. So, you know, in terms of the cost, campaigns are just getting more expensive in general. You know, even state Senate races have become quite expensive. And it's just sort of the nature of the beast at this point. But party does matter to the extent that the two parties will really be trying to drive turnout in a year when a lot of people just decide it's not really worth going to the polls.
So, Dean, explain how you see these candidates defining themselves in their campaigns. Has this been a largely positive campaign, largely negative, mix of two? What do you think?
It's been both. You know, it's gotten personal. It's been very negative at times. I think, you know, it's obviously Ted Gatsis is going to try to paint as positive a picture as possible moving forward, particularly on the opioid crisis, being cognizant of tax cap and taxes. You know, and Joyce Craig obviously is going to go after him for falling short on pretty much all of these areas. So, you know, feels like a pretty typical campaign to me. I think because they were so close last time, you know, Craig lost by 64 votes in a recount. You know, there's a fair bit of negative energy there between the two, which, you know, it's not that surprising.
It's typical, too. I mean, in politics, familiarity breeds contempt.
Right.
You know, we certainly saw that with Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginter. They ran against each other four times. It got nastier and nastier, more and more bitter. This race has been much more bitter than the last one was because it was so close. As Dean said, they both understand that in this kind of election, without a lot of in an off year such as this, and with low turnout, as Dean said, you motivate voters by making them angry. Angry voters are more likely to show up. at an election which is a very low turnout. So that's why Gatsis talks about taxes, because he wants voters to be angry that Joyce Craig, as an alderman and on the school board, has voted for higher spending, and that Gatsis, as mayor, has vetoed budgets because they exceeded the spending cap, and he was overridden several times by the alderman. That's why he's trying to make them angry. That's why Joyce Craig talks about this case of rape at West High and Ted Gatsis not revealing for a couple of years that this 14-year-old was raped in the hallway at West High School until after the student was convicted, because she wants voters angry about the fact that he was trying to hide something.
May the angrier voters win, I guess.
Yes.
Jeez. All right. So this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests today about the week's news. We're going to talk a little bit more about the opioid crisis and local response to it. We're also going to be talking about the task force looking at the future of the Manchester VA Medical Center. Call us now to get in on the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us if you'd rather not be on the air with your voice. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. So this week on the opioid crisis, politicians on both sides of the aisle said this week that it was great that President Trump declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency. But politicians also said that it's not enough. Kevin, we'll start with Governor Sununu's reaction. What was his?
In terms of the opioid crisis?
Yeah, and President Trump's declaration of the public health emergency.
Yeah, certainly. Sununu has praised Trump for taking this issue very seriously and hearing what voters were telling him when he ran for president. That's what people need to remember is New Hampshire sort of put the opioid crisis nationally on the radar for Trump when he was here and he heard about this problem. But Sununu's not happy about essentially the funding formula that the federal government has come up with, and now for the second year is distributing money essentially based on population to these states rather than the severity of the problem. In terms of a per capita basis, New Hampshire's has the second biggest problem in the nation behind only West Virginia, but we're not seeing the resources come from the federal government to match that.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Shaheen and Senator Hassan seem to be in agreement with the governor on this.
They very much are, and we're very critical of the president and Congress this past week. And essentially, that's been Trump's response to this issue with the formula and funding in general, is that's not my job. It's Congress's job to appropriate, and they can decide to change the formula if they wish to do it. And they haven't done that through statute.
And meanwhile, there's speculation that former Congressman Frank Ginta is being considered for the job of drug czar. Dean, what's the likelihood of that?
Yeah, I don't know. This is a story we've been talking about for quite some time now. I think even going back to either shortly before or after President Trump's inauguration, he had involvement with a drug task force. We'll see. I haven't heard any new reporting on this. Perhaps, Kevin, have you?
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
no.
It seems like it's sort of the same thing kind of cycling around. You know, what's interesting for me on the spending issue is, and again, there was some hope over the summer that this opioid crisis would be declared a national emergency, which would allow immediate access to emergency funds. Instead, we're going to go the longer route of a public health emergency, and Congress has to appropriate money. Senators Shaheen and Hassan are sponsoring a bill that would bring $45 billion in money over 10 years. You know, part of the concern is that President Obama, late in his term, signed the 21st Century Cures Act, which is about a $6.3 billion act that there was hope it was going to provide money for New Hampshire. New Hampshire's only getting about $6 million out of a $6 billion bill. So there was some disappointment there. So, you know, I think that the consensus has been that things are moving in the right direction, but not quite at the pace or financial level that people had hoped.
And one person who's upset about the way the opioid crisis is going right now is Manchester Police Chief Nick Willard. He said this week that the opioid-related problems are not law enforcement issues, and he threw the ball, so to speak, in the court of social service agencies. Kevin, the union leader reported on his remarks this week, and maybe I'm sort of misinterpreting what I just read on the page, but it seemed like there was quite a bit of frustration in his voice.
Yeah, I think there is. I think the police chief in Manchester is sounding a lot like people in law enforcement throughout the state in New Hampshire in dealing with this opioid crisis, which is to say the first response to dealing with this in New Hampshire, and I think by elected officials as well as law enforcement, was to kind of flood the zone in New Hampshire with more resources for law enforcement to go after dealers, to try and stem the flow of drugs into the community. And I think what Willard essentially is saying is whether it's the Granite Hammer program that was funded by the legislature through the state budget and any other number of resources we've gotten from the federal government, that we're kind of tapped out here. Willard is saying that this is a social service problem, that namely there needs to be more money for child protection for children who are around families that are using opioids, and also for drug treatment and prevention, that's the solution, is that as long as the demand socially is for these drugs among people who are addicted, we can have as many cops on the street, but they're still going to keep using.
There was a very there was a very interesting report out last week, actually by a Keene State professor, that got at the heart of this. She surveyed the chiefs of police across New Hampshire, and I believe a majority of them responded, asking them about their thoughts on the opioid crisis, how the response was going, their role within that. And a majority of them shared Willard's view that this is not primarily, should not be a law enforcement issue. One of the numbers I found most interesting was about 30% of those police chiefs said they've actually, this crisis has led them to rethink their views on decriminalization of small amounts of illegal drugs. That's kind of phenomenal. One in three police chiefs, the folks who you think would are so frustrated and sort of confounded by this that they're rethinking that policy as well. At the same time though, we're sort of there's inklings of a sort of backlash in some ways against this. This view that you can't arrest your way out of the problem, as we've heard. A candidate for alderman in Manchester has been campaigning on a platform. Among the things he's campaigning on is to lock up folks who are rescued by Narcan by first responders. That first responders are getting fatigued by resuscitating folks who've overdosed with Narcan and then seeing them, 2 days or a week later in the same house. So there's reason to believe that this sort of more compassionate approach of treating it as an illness and emphasizing treatment and recovery over handcuffs, at least in some quarters, maybe running thin.
It's fascinating to me. We've been talking about this issue for several years now on the roundup, and there was a time where the argument, not only politically but just in terms of law enforcement, was that that's the way to go. And if you focused on addiction, that was being soft on crime, and you needed to kind of arrest your way out of the problem. Now we've gone in the other direction, which has been a really interesting change to watch. But you are starting to see, particularly with the wide availability of Narcan, concern among some people that, because addicts know they can be revived with this stuff, there's not an incentive to really deal with the underlying problem. And I think that's some of the concern you're hearing. But we're in a very different place in terms of conceptualizing this problem than we were even just 4 or 5 years ago.
It's true. And law enforcement, too, has really come around to this Good Samaritan law that New Hampshire has, where you can essentially not be prosecuted if you report someone who is overdosing. Initially, a lot of police initially, when the legislature passed that, said this is a bad idea. It's going to lead to more. We're essentially sanctioning people who are using drugs out there and giving them, shielding them from being prosecuted. Most law enforcement now credit that with actually helping them get treatment for the people who really need it.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with Kevin Landrigan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, NHPR's News Director Dan Barrick, and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, and with you. If you've got questions about the week's news, please let us know. Still to come, we're going to be talking about the storm that blew through New Hampshire last weekend and still has some people in the dark. Electrical companies are working hard to get people's power back. We'll also be talking about the task force looking into the future of the Manchester VA. And those bears. Remember those bears? We're going to be talking about them. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We'll learn more in just a few. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR's Dan Barrick, Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And with you, call us with your questions about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to start talking about the storm that blew through New Hampshire this weekend and left a lot of people without power. Governor Chris Sununu toured the storm damage across the state, and he said he thought New Hampshire would meet the threshold for federal assistance. And this is from WMUR.
When you're up here in Grafton County and what you know is going on in Carroll and some of the other northern counties in the state, that's where you really need to be here to understand the power of the water that you see behind us today and what it's really doing to roads, to culverts, to dams, really undermining and causing some very serious concerns.
So that was Governor Sununu. And I'll go to you, Dean. So he's talking about some of the northern counties. Is that where the impact was most hard felt?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, this is, as you mentioned, I think this is the fourth largest power lossage on record. It's interesting if you look at the top four. I think two are ice storms and two are wind and rain storms, something like that. I think it's an even split. We had over 250,000 out at the peak. I think there may be 10 to 14,000. It might even be lower than that now. It's supposed to be substantially back on by tonight. So they made tremendous progress in 5 days. Yeah, I think the biggest surprise, my sense from listening to people who follow this stuff in, you know, the weather, weathermen, et cetera, is that they didn't expect this to be so far inland and so far north. They thought it was going to be more of a coastal event. But you had, as we heard the governor talk about the northern counties, you know, we saw pretty dramatic imagery from Campton and Warren, the Lincoln area up to Mount Washington. I think they got 4+ inches of rain. Plus, we've had a couple rainstorms in succession. There's been in succession. There's been a tremendous amount of rain with all the wind on top of it. And then also out, you know, the Sunapee region as well got hit pretty hard in that band that runs up through Warren to the Lakes region. So, yeah, I think it was more widespread and more intense. You know, my understanding was they were sort of planning for it in advance, but you never know until it actually hits. But, you know, 5 days, we don't have to deal with freezing temperatures, so you don't have, you know, pipe bursting issues and all that kind of stuff that you get with ice storms. Mm-hmm. But still, certainly an inconvenience for a lot of people.
Yeah, some of the photos, I mean, I think the Conway Daily Sun had a photo of Route 2 in between Gorham and the Maine state border, where it looked like an earthquake had hit that road,
A lot of buckling.
It did, yeah. There was a lot of buckling. I think one of the problems was there's quite a bit of water, that rain that preceded the storm. And I think that's what caused a lot of the roads to collapse up there. If you're not from the North Country, as I am, you don't really appreciate what a problem a storm like this can create. And the problem really is access. Is what you don't get anywhere in New Hampshire other than the North Country is very few major corridors on which to travel up there. So if you have a major road that's closed, say Route 302 going through Crawford Notch is closed. Well, that means if you live in like Twin Mountain and you're trying to go to Conway, then what was a 20-minute trip probably becomes almost an hour and 15-minute trip because of the roads you have to take because that major artery is closed. That's why this is a major problem up there and will continue to be for many, many weeks. Some say it'll take as long as 6 months to get all the roads back in full service.
So what do you think? Is it likely that we'll get the federal disaster declaration?
I would think so, yeah, simply because with these disaster declarations, one of the things you need to keep in mind is essentially the cost that the federal government will reimburse most easily is essentially to state and local infrastructure. It's really not. So if an earthquake comes and it levels 100 private homes— if it doesn't destroy the roads leading to those homes, you may not get the disaster declaration. But here, we had more than 200 major roads in the state of New Hampshire that were closed by this storm that requires, I'm sure it's going to be in the millions and millions of dollars in terms of road improvements are going to have to occur to bring the infrastructure back into service.
And meanwhile, I believe the report issued this morning was that there are still, you know, about 1,000 people without power. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think that's a number. Certainly, Eversource and New Hampshire Electric Cooperative.
Yeah, yesterday it was about 14,000. It's probably much lower.
Yeah,
than that
it is
now.
Much lower. They made a lot of progress in the last couple of days. A couple of nights ago, even from like 7 o'clock to 11 p.m. on Wednesday, they cut the number down by almost 25,000. So they've really succeeded in hitting their target, which is by the end of the week to get substantially restored.
They have 600 crews out, something like that. It's fascinating if you're on social media. Eversource has been doing a lot of explaining because people want to know when is my power coming on. And there's compared to some of those storms from 8-10 years ago, just much better communication now. But you also get a little insight into how they make decisions about what to restore first and what to put off until later.
Fascinating. Okay, let's move on. We've got some more stories to talk about this week. One of them was that the meeting of the task force put together to look at the future of veterans health care in New Hampshire. 2-day meeting this week, and they're basically looking at options for things like, you know, primary care, rehabilitation service, geriatric medicine, looking at options. So, Dean, what do you make of the progress of this task force so far?
Well, I think there's a hope that it's finally going to get on track. We've had this sort of big episode with Michael Mayo Smith being removed from the task force and being replaced by Dr. Jennifer Lee. This was her first meeting with the task force. You know, the big questions are questions that we've talked about for some time now. Should the Manchester VA be expanded? Should vets increasingly rely on private care options in the area? So these are pretty important discussions, and it probably takes some time to come up with a reasonable set of recommendations. But I think there is a sense that, you know, given the whole issue with the whistleblowers and the whistleblowers complaining that, you know, Mayo Smith was part of the problem, now that he's been swapped out for somebody else, I think there's a hope that it's going to move forward more efficiently.
Though fascinating that Dr. Mayo Smith does remain an advisor, and at one point at this meeting this week, he did actually speak to the task force, which might go against VA Central Office comments last week that he should remain, the committee should remain independent. Kevin, were you following this as well?
Yeah, I think in some respects, certainly the whistleblowers are not happy with Mayo Smith. They think he's part of the problem. They think he's why we are where we are. And that's why they wanted him off as co-chair of the task force. The congressional delegation agreed, and ultimately so did VA Secretary Shulkin in removing him. But he is the chief administrator. So I think the task force is going to need him as a resource, essentially to help them understand where Manchester is and how it can go where it needs to go in the future. He's going to need to be consulted by the task force. So it makes sense for him to have at least some adjunct role. We can call on him to give testimony as to what's going on the ground.
Mm-hmm. And I should mention that I spoke with Dr. Mayo Smith this week, but he declined to speak on the record and answer any questions related to the task force, referred me to his press secretary. So I want to ask one more thing about veterans issues this week, which was that Senator Maggie Hassan spoke with Allison Jaslow at a public event. Jaslow is an Army veteran and executive director of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Kevin, what was the substance of that event?
Yeah, they really want to talk about eliminating barriers that many women veterans face at these VA centers across the state. And essentially, the biggest barrier is preserving privacy for these women, particularly those who are suffering sexual trauma. You did some reporting on this at the New Hampshire VA Medical Center. After the flood that occurred last summer, a lot of women felt very uncomfortable with the arrangements that had been made in Manchester, in that the women's clinic was put on the sixth floor. So women who were suffering from real difficult problems had to go up in the elevator, in a public elevator, and be seen as going into this women's clinic. And the interim director, Montoya, I won a lot of praise from the congressional delegation for acting in response to their complaints and having the clinic move back down to the first floor for women, and also giving them a separate entrance so they can come and go with some modicum of privacy. Hassan and Senator Jeanne Shaheen are co-sponsoring legislation that would require VA centers to have a minimum of health care providers on staff dealing with women, and also require these medical centers to be sensitive to the needs of women veterans.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. Give us a call if you have questions about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. We also want to let you know about some shows that we're planning for next week. On Monday, on the Exchange, we'll be talking with Perry Plummer, Director of New Hampshire Homeland Security and Emergency Management. That's about storm recovery. So feel free to weigh in on that on Monday or send your questions by email ahead of time. exchange@nhpr.org is the email address. Also on Monday, we're going to be speaking with Roger Savini, Commissioner of New Hampshire Insurance Department. He'll be on the Exchange to take questions about the most recent enrollment period for the health insurance for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, which is what we should talk about right now because that was in the news this week. Of course, the open enrollment period began on the 1st of November. And Dan Barrick, it seems like, you know, in the face of so much uncertainty, insurance companies have raised rates. Who's going to bear the brunt of that, Dan?
Well, yeah, this comes after a number of years where rates have remained relatively flat, and there are some pretty steep rate increases there. I think the average rate increase is going to be right around 50%. But that's not for everyone, and largely the folks who are going to be spared that are low income folks who qualify for the subsidies that are part of the Affordable Care Act. In many cases, their out of pocket expenses will actually be the same or possibly even less than in the past. But for those who don't qualify, those people of, you know, make too much income to qualify, they may see some pretty sharp increases in their premiums.
And Dean, what might that do politically? Was that going to sort of tank Obamacare, or are people going to blame the Trump administration for what they view as sabotage of Obamacare? What do you think?
Well, that's certainly, Democrats are certainly arguing that that's the case, that all the talk about Obamacare falling apart under its own weight is really a cover for President Trump actively trying to dismantle it. We've talked about these cost-sharing subsidies that may be cut. And so we'll see. But there is a lot of instability. I think the Medicaid expansion is going to be a central part of this. One of the key debates in the debate over repealing and replacing Obamacare has been about what do you do with all the folks in the states where expanded Medicaid was adopted, as in here we got at least 50,000 people who would be affected. So it's a very political issue. A lot of finger pointing. You know, is Obamacare really failing, or is it failing because the Trump administration is intentionally neglecting things that it could do to keep it viable?
And one other relatively small, but I think could be significant change too, is among the other changes that the Trump administration has made to Affordable Care Act is cutting what the open enrollment period in half. So it's gone from 90 days in the past to only 45 days, which folks who pay attention to this say could really lead to many fewer people signing up, and
their
words eroding, not spending money on marketing and advertising.
And obviously you're not only cutting it off at a period of time like 2 weeks before Christmas,
right.
So
15th.
people's attentions are not necessarily on this topic. And more likely, a lot of that's why they get a lot of people signing up at the beginning of the year, because the year ends and you start thinking about, okay, what's going to be my coverage next year? So the delegation is very unhappy with what's going on, and that's why they're doing a lot of events to publicize the event, open enrollment.
Yeah, certainly a lot of political decisions having to do with healthcare. And got a question about healthcare, maybe a comment from Skip in Stratford. Skip, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, just a brief comment. Yeah, my wife, we just got notice that our insurance is going up from $18,000 this year, my wife and I. Next year, the policy will cover a lot less. It's going to be $28,000. That's a 65% increase. So I don't see this being talked about a whole lot. So I'm very, very grateful that you're talking about it this morning.
Well, Skip, do you get your health care from the Exchange or from an employer?
From the exchange.
Okay. Yes. Well, thank you very much for calling and sharing your insight. I mean, this is something that, I mean, we got an email through the general NHPR email address this week where someone wrote in that their healthcare costs are going up more than 1,000%, right? And that's, you know, anecdotal, of course, but one of those things that some people are going to see as healthcare starts to evolve this year.
We've been talking about here in New Hampshire, some of the numbers we've kicked around have been, 40% increase, 45% increase, maybe higher if the cost-sharing subsidies are stopped. This particular discussion hits individuals on the exchanges who are not Medicaid eligible particularly hard. Those are the folks, I think, who are bearing the brunt of the cost increases. And we don't know Skip's situation, but it may very well be that he's just buying as an individual or as a family without the added benefit of the qualifying for Medicaid.
Yeah, and you ask the question, is the health care of these individuals who are buying insurance, are they a higher risk than people on Medicaid? And the answer is no, they're actually not. But it's all about really the comfort of large numbers. These insurance rates are going up by smaller amounts for people who get the subsidies because they're in larger and larger pools of people in Medicaid. And while these individual insurance plans, they're all ones and twos. They're very small kind of boutique policies you're buying just for yourself. So if there's someone with a health risk in those small plans, the insurance company is going to lose a ton of money. So they rate the risk much higher than they rate the risk of these larger pools of subsidized people.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We've just got a few minutes left. I want to ask you, Kevin, quickly about the race to be the next Speaker of the New Hampshire House. This was a big political story this week. There was a forum. A bunch of candidates took part. Who took part, and what did they say?
Yeah, there are six Republicans and the House Democratic leader, Steve Shurtleff, were at this forum hosted by the House Freedom Caucus, which is a conservative group. The Republicans have the votes in the House of Representatives. So by all accounts, Sean Jasper's replacement will be a Republican, will come from those folks. Certainly the two leading contenders here you have to look at would be Deputy Speaker Gene Chandler, who's the Speaker's second in command. He's been the Speaker a number of terms in the past until he had to resign with ethics issues at the time that have since been resolved. And Lori Sanborn, who barely lost to Sean Jasper the last time Jasper became Speaker. This contest will be decided on November 30th.
Okay, Kevin, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I want to thank everybody who's been here today, NHPR News Director Dan Barrick and Dean Spiliotis of SNHU. Thank you very much. We appreciate your being here.
Thanks, Peter.
But we didn't get to the bear story, unfortunately, but just to summarize really quickly, one of the three bears that raided trash cans in the Upper Valley earlier this year, they were relocated to the North Country, and unfortunately we learned this week that one of them was shot and killed by a hunter. The other two, still unaccounted for, but typically, you know, a certain percentage of bears, when they are moved, do get killed. That's something we reported on when it happened, and it seems like that's bearing out. So, no pun intended, of course. This is the Weekly News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.